Okay, folks, I don't have a wireless speaker, so I'm stuck behind the podium till I get one. But quick reminders in case you need them. First is that your mystery project is due this Friday at 5. Your next quiz is a week from today. I told you things will stack up. Hey, I know next week is the start of Thanksgiving week, and I toyed with different timings for this quiz, and nothing was optimal. I considered giving the quiz after the Thanksgiving, but you don't want this hanging over your head during Thanksgiving weekend. Most people would like to get it done. I thought about doing it day after tomorrow, but that's too early. So kind of got stuck with the Monday, and if you have to miss it, you have to miss it. And in case you've decided that you're far away, you could to get back to family. You know the rules. Basically, the 10% gets moved up to the final. Right? So if you have to miss it, just let me know. Okay, so let's get started. We're going to do our usual stuff. We're going to start with, today we're going to actually finish off relative valuation or pricing. So I thought I'd show you a page which is what I call a scattershot page. This is a page from an equity research report that I pulled up. I'm not passing judgment on the report, but this is a page that, the equity research analyst sector includes a lot of social media and young tech companies. And what you see on this page essentially is a summary of numbers that he used to write his equity research report. So you see enterprise value, you see equity value, you see projected EBITDA 2014, 2015, 2016, price earnings. The point I'm trying to make is if you look at this page, you could conceivably compute as many as 10 different multiples for each company. And one of the things we're going to talk about today is when you take any company or any group of companies, you can compute 5 multiples, 10, 15 different multiples. And you can actually get different answers for your company, whether it's undervalued or overvalued, depending on which multiple you use. So one of the things we're going to wrestle with today is how do you pick the right multiple to price your company? How do you decide between these 10? So remember this page when we start talking about that, because maybe at the end of that discussion, if I gave you this page, you can say, this is the right multiple to use for this sector. This is why. Okay? So let's build on that. Okay? So let's assume that you use pricing and you use relative valuation, you use a number of different multiples, earnings, book value, revenue, and that you've come up with a relative valuation of a company, a software company, and you're trying to decide which multiple to use in your valuation. It's an extension of what we were just talking about. I'm going to give you the choices, and this is something that's relevant for your mystery project as well. So as I go through these choices, start thinking about, assuming you got started on it. If you didn't, just let it go. So here are your choices. You have 10 different multiples. Rather than pick one, you are going to take 10 different multiples, use them all, and compute an average across all 10. You see what I mean by that? Use price earnings, you come up with the value of equity. Use EV to EBITDA, you come up with the value of equity. At the end, you're going to have 10 different values of equity. You're going to use all 10. So that's your first choice. The second is maybe you're in a sector where everybody's using a specific multiple. EV to EBITDA if you're in the telecom sector. PEG ratios if you're in the technology sector. Maybe that's your best choice if everybody else is using it. The third choice is the multiple that best captures what investors in that sector seem to be pricing stocks on. So as an example, if you remember when we looked at Twitter and the social media companies, do you remember what variable investors were focused on when they were pricing social media companies? What were they looking at? Number of users. Okay. Now you and I might say that makes no sense. You shouldn't be using number of users. You should be looking at revenues. I hate podiums so much. Thank God I'm free. You should use revenue, but that doesn't matter. So maybe that's the thing to do is look to see what people are pricing stocks on and then zone in on that. The fourth is maybe the multiple you should use is the one that best incorporates the fundamentals. Remember the fundamentals, growth, cash flows, risk. Maybe your answer is none of the above, in which case you better come up with some way of picking between different multiples. So you see the choices? Take an average across multiple multiples. The second is pick the multiple that everybody else is using. The third is pick a multiple that seems to best reflect what people are pricing things on, price to user, price to subscriber. The fourth is pick the multiple that best reflects fundamentals, or maybe the answer is none of the above. Anybody want to give me a choice? Because in a sense, you're facing this with a mystery project as well, right? You've run four regressions and one has a high R squared. So should I go statistic with the highest R squared? Should I go with the one that best explains fundamentals? What do you think you should do? So you're saying C? If you do that, the answer was C, which is to pick them up. If you do that, remember we talked about pricing versus valuing, investing versus trading? Under what condition should you pick C? C is the right answer if what is true. You're a trader or an investor? You're a trader, you go with C because you don't care about value anymore. You're saying, look, I want to buy at 625. In fact, on Friday, I had the misfortune of being interviewed on CNBC on Amazon. It's a misfortune because it's a stock you can't explain, right? Those of you trying to value, there are at least five people in this class trying to value Amazon. And none of you is coming close to the price, which is like $650 per share. So CNBC anchor asks, how do you explain the $650? To which my first response is, I didn't pay it. Why the hell are you asking me? But I was there. They were, on camera. They want you to say something profound. So I said, maybe people are focusing on the Field of Dreams model. The Field of Dreams model is, right? Remember the Field of Dreams, the movie? Kevin Costner builds a baseball field in the middle of Iowa. It was Iowa, right? The cornfields. And remember what he said? If I build it, they will come. Who's they? Stonewall Jackson. What is his name again? The guy with the... Shoeless Jackson, not Stonewall Jackson. Maybe Stonewall Jackson should have come out too, right? And the whole movie is about building the field on a dream. And at the end, of course, it's a movie. So, of course, these baseball players come out of the cornfields. See, what's this got to do with Amazon? What's Amazon's model? What's Jeff Bezos told us what's a bargain he's made with us? We're going to get the revenues first. And in fact, he's very open about the fact that he sells everything at below cost. Amazon Prime, $99 per year, right? You know what it costs Amazon? For each Prime member? In fact, it's right in the financials. They tell you how much Amazon Prime cost them. It cost them $6 billion last year. Because for every $99 they collect, they give away $399 in free shipping and media and everything else you get with it. And he said, that's okay. If we build it, they will come. If you build what? If we get the revenues, the profits will come. And you know what? It's not an implausible argument because if you trust him enough, say, hey, they're going to get enough market power by the time this process is done. Look at all the brick and mortar retailers looking at Christmas. Usually Christmas is your best time of the year. They're all looking with incredible fear at what this Christmas is going to deliver. And you're talking about the Macy's, the Walmarts, the Targets. Maybe this is the plan all along, is make everybody else go out of business and charge you $999 for Prime. Where are you going to go? Amazon is the only. So there is a plausible path. That's a Field of Dreams model. Or maybe they're not even looking at what the future will bring. They're pricing it based on revenue growth. See, that makes no sense. Remember what I said. Doesn't matter what you and I think makes sense. It's what people are focused on. With Amazon, they're focused on revenues and revenue growth, and they don't care about profits. Which means if you're an intrinsic value person and you go sell short on Amazon, what's going to happen to you? You're going to get stomped like a caveman in front of a group of mammoths. There's no way you're going to get out of the way. The game is not your game, and sometimes you've got to step away and say, this is not my game, I'm going somewhere else. So in my perspective, from an intrinsic value perspective, I don't think Amazon is a good investment. It's not even close. But I'm not going to go to the next Amazon. Therefore, I'm going to sell short on the company because it's a pricing game. If you're an investor, though, and you want to use multiples, then you'd pick D. Because in a sense, you want to pick the multiple that best incorporates fundamentals. You want to explain the differences based on cash flows and growth and risk. So there is no right answer until you've picked what you try to do. You're saying, why don't I pick one? You know why, right? You take 10 rotten numbers, you put them in a pot, you stir them up, you pull an average out. The average is not good. This is not the law of large numbers working in your favor. So never average across multiples. So if you see an IPO pricing where the analyst has used five different multiples to attach price to the company and then averages the five, what that tells you is the analyst has no idea what he's doing or she's doing. Don't even read the rest of the report. As for why you might not use the multiple that other analysts use, sometimes sectors shift. It might have been that this was the multiple that best fit this sector 5 years ago, 10 years ago, 15 years ago. People get stuck to multiples no matter what. So now let's get to the next step. Let's assume you pick a multiple and you arrive at... So let's first start off by assuming you do an intrinsic valuation of this company, just like you have on your company. Came up with a value of $10 per share. Stock price is 15. You do a pricing of this company, a relative valuation against the sector, and come up with 20. So you've got three numbers here. 15 is the price, 10 is your intrinsic value, 20 is the relative value. This is, again, something you're going to face at the end of your big project where you have to decide whether you're going to buy or sell a stock, right? So I'm going to read some choices, and you tell me which one best fits where you would be if you got these three numbers. The first is that the stock is undervalued because the price is less than the relative value. 15 is less than 20. Stock is overvalued. Price is greater than the intrinsic value. The stock is correctly valued. You know how you got there? You took your 10 and your 20, added the 2, divided by 2. You averaged out an intrinsic valuation and a relative valuation. The fourth is, and this would be nice if you can pull this off because you're like a market strategist. You're right no matter what. The stock is both under and overvalued. Fifth, none of the above. You see what the choice I've given you? You've got an intrinsic value, you've got a relative value. The price is in the middle. I'm asking you what you're going to do. And the answer, in a sense, is close to what Schiff suggested for the first one, which is if you're a trader and you want to price things, which one are you going to focus on? The $20 per share. If you're an investor and you care about value, you're going to pick the... There's no right answer. It depends on what your choice is. The one thing you cannot do, though, is add the two numbers and divide by two. That's another deadly giveaway in an IPO where people say, I've done a DCF valuation, I've done a multiple, I'm going to add the two numbers and divide by two. That is a non-starter. You cannot, philosophically, two very different ways of thinking about investing. Don't bring them together by averaging them out. And don't try to have it both ways. It can't be under and overvalued. You're either an investor or a trader. Make your choice because that's going to determine. So each of you will have to make this choice at the end of this class. It's not a permanent choice. You can come back and revisit it. So don't put too much weight on it, partly because you're probably going to be making this choice on Saturday night at 11:48 and the summary is due to me at midnight. You have 12 minutes anyway. But you have the rest of your investing life to think about it because this is a fundamental choice that each of us has to make at some point in time. Are we investors? Are we traders? There's nothing inherently good or bad about either. But once you pick your game, you need to play that game. Last choice. Remember last session we started on market regressions where I took the entire market and ran a regression? Let's say you take the Zyloft. Remember you have a $10 intrinsic value, $15 price per share, and now you run a you get $15 per share, you get $20 from the relative valuation against the sector, but you run a regression against the entire market, and you go back to $10. See why you could get two different answers for the relative value? In the first one, I'm looking just at your sector and saying, based on how the sector is priced, this is what the number is. Now I'm saying, based on what the market's being priced at, your number is $10. Now, which one would you pick, the 10 or the 20, and what does it depend on? If you're an equity research analyst in the sector or a portfolio manager who runs a sector fund, you know what I mean by a sector fund? You're a biotech fund portfolio manager. Which one are you going to pick? What's your job? If you're a sell-side analyst, biotech stocks, your job is to tell me what looks cheap relative to the sector. You're a portfolio manager in the biotech sector. Your job is to make money relative to the sector. Do you see where it's going to push you, right? It's going to push you towards the $20. But if you run a market fund where you can pick biotech stocks or choose not to invest in them, you're going to go with the $10 per share because you don't have to buy biotech stocks because when you get two very different numbers, that's like the Amazon.com regression that we ran where Amazon looked cheap relative to the other .com stocks, but .com stocks collectively were overpriced against the market. And that's why it makes sense to run that third analysis. Intrinsic value, relative value against the sector, and relative value against the market. Each has its play in your investment decision and might as well know what the three numbers look like. Any questions? Okay. So let's go back to the notes and finish off our market regressions because we were... So what I'm going to do next, remember, so last session we looked at P/E ratios against the entire market, and we ran a regression of P/E against growth, payout, and beta against the entire market. Today I'm going to start off with PEG ratios. And when I introduced PEG ratios in class, I told you how much I disliked this multiple. But let's say I want us to look at it, what drives that multiple. Again, I started off by testing that proposition. The rationale for using PEG ratios that analysts use is we use PEG ratios when we're making growth go away. So I want to see whether that was true. So I took PEG ratios and put the scatter plot against growth rate. Again, kind of a crazy-looking graph, right? I know this might look like I'm looking for things, but it looks to me like there's a curve in that distribution. It's not linear. You know, if you were fitting something through, it looks like it goes through that. I'm going to do something that I find pretty useful whenever I have a variable that's giving me trouble. So when you ran your regression, for instance, in your mystery project, you could plot the numbers and you'd see sometimes they're not linear. This tends to work for me. Statistics professors are going to kill me for saying this. Most of the time in finance, when a variable is giving you trouble because it has too many outliers, big differences, take the natural log of that variable. So just open up an Excel column, take the natural log. What it does is it narrows the spread between the variables. And when I do that with growth rates, instead of using the actual growth rate, I use the log of the growth rate, I get a distribution that's much more linear. Try this out if you have a non-linear relationship. So then I ran a regression of PEG against three variables. The beta, the payout ratio, similar to before, but now I threw the log of the growth instead of the actual growth rate. So there was an intermediate step where I stopped and checked and said, look, if I just ran a linear regression, the variable growth is not linearly related to PEG ratio, so I'm going to take the log of the growth rate. Again, all the T statistics are significant. The higher the beta, the lower the PEG ratio. Makes sense. The higher the payout ratio, the higher the PEG ratio. Makes sense. And the higher the growth rate, the lower the PEG ratio. I don't even know whether that makes sense or not, because remember there's that U-shaped relationship. But at least across the market, higher growth companies tend to have lower PEG ratios. The one thing, though, that is a little troubling is that the intercept is a negative number. Statistics, intercepts can be negative numbers. And normally you wouldn't worry about it. But here's the reason it worries you when you use this to make predicted values for companies. So I take a company, I take this regression, I plug the numbers for this company into the regression. Because the intercept is a negative number, I can end up with a negative expected PEG ratio, right? And we know that PEG ratios and PE ratios are bounded at zero. We don't want them to drop below zero. So this is the great thing about statistics packages today. When you run a regression in Minitab or SPSS or SAS, I don't know whether Excel gives you this choice, there's a little box that says, do you want me to remove the intercept? No intercept in the regression. And if you check that box off, here's what will happen. It'll take the intercept out of the regression. It's not as good a regression as the previous one because, in a sense, what it's doing is moving the line to go through the origin. It takes the intercept out. So this is a regression without the intercept, and the reason I've removed the intercept is because that negative value is giving me too many predicted negative PEG ratios. Again, a little trick in statistics to make your predicted values at least mostly positive, but that you do that if you have a big if it's a small negative intercept, you can let it go. Maybe you should test it out and see what you get as negative. If you get a lot of negative predicted values, one way to get around that is to remove the intercept from the regression, force the regression through the origin. So that's pretty much it. I ran the regression for not just the U.S. I ran it for every other segment I have in my database. Remember, in my database, I have 40,800 companies, and I break them down into four groups, U.S., Europe, Japan, emerging markets. Actually, I broke it down to five groups. The fifth group was Australia and Canada, but nobody cares about Australia and Canada, so I took it out. I'm sorry. If you're from Australia and Canada, don't take it personally. But it's like running a mining... Basically, it's mostly mining companies. You get these ups and downs. But I ran a global regression as well. First, notice the R-squareds are not good for any of the regressions. Let it go. Nothing you can do about it. The data is the data. Don't sit there saying, what can I do to increase the R-squared? The data doesn't have a strong relationship. How the heck are you going to make it stronger? And that's my advice to you in the mystery project as well. Don't sit there beating a regression to death, making the R-squared go up because the data is the data. So those are my regressions. I ran the regression against growth, payout, and beta. The signs are all the same on all the regressions, but how much the market is paying for growth varies across markets, the coefficient on growth. I ran the regression for price to book. First thing you notice is the R-squareds become much higher than they were with P-E ratios. P-E ratios are the worst possible multiple of all to focus on because they tend to be very volatile. Why? Because earnings per share is the absolute bottom line in the accounting statement, right? So everything affects it. So price to book, the R-squareds are higher. Again, I ran the regression against growth, beta, payout, and return equity. Notice in some of the regressions, you might see a missing variable. The reason it's missing is if the t-statistic on that variable is not statistically significant, I take it out of the regression. You do not want regressions where two of the variables have no real relationship to your dependent variable. So again, across markets, and the way I'd use it is if you came to me with an emerging market company, say, tell me what the price to book should be for this company, I'll plug the numbers in the emerging market regression and say, that's what it is. So what is it against the rest of the globe? Not a problem. I'll take the global regression, plug it in, and tell you what it is. Then I took EBITDA, ran the regression against growth, debt ratio, and tax rate. Again, if you're wondering where these variables show up from, go back to our original when we did the analysis of the multiples, and you see these variables pop up when you do the algebra. Again, the R-squareds become absolutely abysmal. I don't know what this fixation with EV/EBITDA that analysts have. Somehow they think that EV/EBITDA is magical. It's actually a horrible multiple to be able to explain differences across companies on. And finally, EV to sales. Mid-teen R-squareds. Right? Again, the variables, growth, margin, debt ratio, and tax rate across. So essentially, with each regression, what I'm doing is I'm going back to the variables that should drive this regression. So if you go to my website, you'll see these regressions updated at the start of every year. And if you don't like the way a regression is set up, the raw data is there as well. Download it and run your own regression. I'm not claiming that this is the right regression. This was the regression that I came up on after I did a little, but I stopped after about 30 minutes. That's my limit with each regression, 30 minutes. I'm done. I'm not going to keep exploring the data here because it can be a full-time job. If you really want to build a quant fund around data, the data is here now. You just have to learn how to live with that data. So let's pull everything we've talked about in pricing together in a couple of propositions. The first is when you do a relative valuation of pricing, all you're telling me when you tell me something is cheap is that it's cheaper than whatever you compared it to. So all relative valuation judgments are, in a sense, conditional statements. Second, there are no similar assets in equity valuations. If you value a company, you will never find a company exactly like yours. So when you say comparable, there is a subjective judgment that goes in, and you have to control for differences. And finally, no matter what you say about relative valuation, it is pricing, not valuation. So keep it in its right place, and you will then be able to make sense of why an equity research report can give you a very different analysis than a discounted cash flow valuation, because you're trying to do something very, very different. So now let's talk about this final piece of relative valuation. So let's say that each week as we were going through a multiple, you decided to try this on your company. Nobody did this, but let's say you were going along. So when I did PE, you tried that for your company. PEG, you tried that for your company. Price to book, you tried that for your company. EV to sales, EV to EBITDA. By now, you should have 8 different relative valuations of your company. So what do I do now? I'll give you the choices. The first and really bad choice is to take a simple average of the 8 numbers, and we talked about why that's bad. The second is you might decide to bring your quant skills to play. You have 8 different multiples. You have 8 different values for your company, but they're not equally precise, right? Some are more precise than others. You say, how would I know? Let's say you ran regressions for each of the 8. When you ran the regressions, what's your measure of precision? The R-squared and the range around the number, right? Because when you get a high R-squared. So let's say you took the 8 values that you got and you put the standard errors of the estimates right next to them. And presumably, if you want to bring your quant skills, you can weight the lower standard error estimates more, and essentially you could come up with a weighted average. This will let you show your quant skills tremendously. Go for it if you want to. But my suggestion is, unless you want to get stuck in quant land, pick one multiple and run with it. Your part of you will say, but we did all the work for 9 different multiples. We don't want to throw the other 8 away. Why not If they don't help you make a better prediction, let them go. You're saying, which one should I pick? I could give you a cynical answer and say, pick the one that best fits your story. I'll make a prediction. You've all got a discounted cash flow valuation of your company, most of you at least. And that value is either higher than the price or lower than the price. I'll give you a minute to think about what you got. You now have to do a relative valuation of your company. That comes after the mystery project. What would make your write-up really easy to do? A relative valuation that agrees with your discounted cash flow valuation, or a relative valuation that is contrary to your discounted cash flow valuation? Go along. I'm playing my cynical self. Let's go along. This is not about truth and justice. This is about getting a project done by December 12th and writing a report that looks really, really good. Guess what? You want a relative valuation that tells you roughly what it is. That's where you can say, look, I am absolutely certain about this company. Not only did my discounted cash flow valuation deliver the result that the stock was cheap, so did my relative valuation. And guess what? If you try 9 different multiples and different groups of comparables, you will find a combination that works for you. Am I going to stop you? Not in the least. Because it's a place, hopefully, where you will learn about how much bias there is in the process. And the next time an equity research analyst shows you a multiple and comparables, you know what you're going to tell him, right? Hey, I've played this game before. How do you pick that multiple? And why these comparables? So the cynical part of me says, if you have an agenda, you will find a multiple that backs that agenda. Okay? The second is, maybe one of those, you know, maybe you're an engineer. Some of you are engineers, and this whole process is making you really sick. Your ulcers are acting up, saying, this is so subjective. I want something much more concrete. I have a solution for you. Pick the multiple that has the highest R squared. This way, you don't have to subjectively explain. You say, 81% R squared, that's the best multiple. I'm going to use it because it gives me the most precise answer. Move on. The third is to make the multiple that seems to make the most sense for the sector that you're in. This won't help you in the mystery project because you have different sectors. But many of you, when you're looking at your individual companies, are looking at either banks or retailers or chemical companies or whatever the sector is. So I'll give you a very simple way to find out what multiple makes the most sense in a sector. Pick the sector that your company is in. Okay? Then think about the variables that managers in that sector tend to focus on. What do they report? What do they obsess over? So let me throw a few sectors at you. If you're in retailing, what are the two numbers that retailers tend to report every period with not only absolute regularity, but pay a lot of attention to? One is margins. The other is same store sales. You know why they do same store sales, right? Because if you're growing by opening new stores, it's not as powerful as... So same store sales and margins. If the focus is on margins, what multiple makes the most sense given that focus? Reverse what we talked about with companion variables. If you focus on margins, the multiples that make the most sense for you are revenue multiples, because revenues go with margins. Financial service companies, the focus is almost always on return on equity, often with regulatory equity at the base. If your focus is on return on equity, what's the multiple that makes the most sense given that focus? When your quiz is a week from now, you should be price to book, somebody said. Or somebody didn't say, I made it up. Hey? It's price to book, financial service companies. If you go to technology companies, you'll see a lot of focus on growth. And if you see focus on growth, then you're going to see PEG ratios and PE ratios. You tell me what managers in a sector are focused on, I'll tell you what the multiple is going to be based on. And actually, it works even in sectors like social media. Because a lot of social media companies, you talk to them, what do they focus on? Users and user intensity, right? User intensity measuring how long users are on Twitter or Facebook. Not surprisingly, the pricing is based on those variables. Managers are not stupid. They look at what people focus on and they try to deliver what they have to. So it's an interesting way of thinking about multiples. It says, look, it's not what I think is right, it's what people are focusing on. And maybe by looking at what managers focus on, I can get a window in what investors get focused on. So I'm going to close with a table that I got out of those. Remember I talked about the 550 equity research reports I collected 15 years ago and I did the survey? As part of that analysis, what I also tried to find was which multiple seemed to be used most frequently in each sector. So among cyclical manufacturing companies, housing, automobiles, I saw a lot of PE using normalized earnings. You think that's pretty fancy. All they did was took average earnings over 5 years rather than last year's earnings and a lot of PE ratios. Among growth firms, I saw a lot of PEG ratios. Maybe that's starting to change, but they show up repeatedly. Among young growth companies, desperation drives you to revenue multiples, and that's where you stay. Among infrastructure companies, cable, cellular, telecom, holding, steel companies, a lot of EV to EBITDA multiples. REITs, I don't know whether, I think at least a couple of people here are doing real estate investment trusts and master limited partnerships. What makes them unique is they're pass-through entities. You know what I mean by pass-through entities? They basically have to pass through their earnings to investors who get taxed on them. So that's the only sector where I've seen cash flow to equity used consistently, where people add depreciation back to net income, saying you can pay that out as a dividend as well. Financial service companies, a lot of price to book equity, and retailing, a lot of revenue multiples. Used to be price to sales, increasingly enterprise value to sales is showing up. Again, I'm not saying these are the right multiples, but this is what people seem to be using within each sector. And maybe what we need to stop and ask is, has it stopped making sense to use it? Maybe with telecom companies, we have to be moving to a different multiple because these are no longer nice cash flow generating companies. They're risky technology companies. And there might be a point at which the old multiples stop making sense. So relative valuation and intrinsic value, right? Two different ways of thinking about valuation. Intrinsic value, take cash flows, growth, and risk. You put them in a discounted cash flow model and you get a value. Let's say you did that right. In relative valuation, you look across comparables and multiples, you bring them together, you come up with a value. Assuming you do both right, and we've kind of answered it, but let's make sure we get it nailed down. Should you get the same value for the company? Or let me phrase it differently. This is a more interesting question. What has to be true for intrinsic and relative value to deliver roughly the same value across all companies? Market is efficient. If you believe markets are efficient, then the two will be the same. But if you believe markets are efficient, what the hell are you doing taking this class? Because, I mean, if markets are efficient, what are you going to do? Open up the paper, look up the price. Why are you wasting our time valuing companies? So the very fact, I know you needed the credit and that's why you're taking the class maybe, but you know, whatever the reason, if you're interested in valuation, you start to go into this, you have to start off with the presumption that you're doing it because markets make mistakes. And if you do that, you're going to find that intrinsic valuation, relative valuation can and should give you different numbers. And the numbers are different. We talked about which one you should use. It depends on whether you're trading or investing. If you're trading, go with multiples. There's nothing wrong with it. There's nothing ignoble about using them. Just go for it. If you're an investor, then go for the intrinsic value. But never, ever take the average of the two numbers. Okay? Because that's something that really puts you in neither camp, and it's going to get you into trouble. So let's review. We started this process by defining the multiples about four sessions ago, but I know it feels like ancient history. Okay? We checked the multiple to see if it was consistent. Remember that test? If the numerator is an equity value, the denominator should be an equity value. The numerator is a firm or an enterprise value, the denominator should be a firm or an enterprise value, and made sure that it was uniformly estimated for all the companies in the sector. That was the first stop. Then we described the multiple. Sounds fancy, but we put up histograms. Those histograms told us that the statistical properties of multiples are such that using an average is almost always going to get you into trouble. Use medians because the distribution is right skewed. And we look to see how bias creeps in when we create our comparables. Then we analyze the multiple. Again, sounds fancy, but we did some algebra, right? If I gave you an equity multiple, you go back to a dividend discount model. If I give you an enterprise multiple, you go back to an enterprise value model. And you tell me the variables that drive that multiple. And only then do we apply the multiple. Define, describe, analyze, apply. Okay. If you really want to get comfortable with pricing, and this has nothing to do with the class, of course, you should get comfortable before the next quiz. That's a minimal requirement. But if you want to get comfortable with this, my suggestion is just start reading equity research reports because they're all built around pricing and comparables. And ask, if I were on the other side of the table asking this equity research analyst questions, what are the questions I would ask about this buy recommendation or sell recommendation? And after about 10 reports, you'd realize very quickly the weak spots, the places you got to go to test to make sure that something doesn't just look cheap, it is actually cheap. So any questions on multiples? So let's do a little detour. When I started this class, I said there were only two ways, actually three ways to do valuation: intrinsic valuation, relative valuation, and option pricing valuation. And I was surprised that nobody brought up, said, what about the fact that there's liquidation valuation, accounting valuation, sum of the parts valuation? So I'm going to do a detour to show you why I did not classify these as different ways of doing valuation. I'm going to talk about asset-based valuation. What's the difference? Intrinsic valuation, you value a company as a going concern based on its cash flows, growth, and risk. In relative valuation, you value a company based on how similar companies are priced out there. In asset-based valuation, what you do is you take the company apart and you value its assets, and you add them all up. So we have five. So let's take a very simple example. You're a company with five pieces of real estate property. I value each one. I add the five up. I come up with the value for the company. You're saying, why do you want to do that? You're buying the company. There are three places where you'll see asset-based valuation. The first is if your company has to be liquidated. So Glencore gets into enough trouble that they have to liquidate themselves. You have to do an asset-based valuation because you have to sell off each piece to the best possible bidder. Last week when I valued Valiant, I said one of the things that the company might have to consider doing is if it's tainted enough that it's starting to affect its operations, they have to sell its pieces. Bausch & Lomb will have to be sold to the highest bidder. Salix Pharmaceuticals has to be sold to the highest bidder. You have to value it for the parts. So that's the first scenario where we might have to value the assets. The second is if you're an accountant. Fair value accounting, purchase price accounting, all of these almost always require reallocating value across assets. You have to value individual assets. Know what I mean by purchase price accounting? After an acquisition, accountants are called in. They've got to value the pieces of the company and tell you what each piece is worth. It's asset-based valuation. And here's the third. If you're an investor sometimes, you might want to value a company in pieces. You might take Sony and say, what are the different parts of Sony worth? Because your argument is, maybe if the sum of the parts is greater than the whole, then I can buy the entire company, if you're a Bill Ackman or an activist investor with enough money, and keep the difference. Or if I'm not Bill Ackman and I don't have that much money, I can still invest in the company and hope that somebody else does it for me. So there's a place for some for this asset-based valuation in everybody's arsenal. So let's look at how to value a company as a collection of its assets. First, let's look at when it's easiest to do. It's easiest to do, you know. So basically, when you look at each asset and you're trying to value it, you have one of three ways of getting that value. The first is you can do an intrinsic value of each asset. So I could take each piece of real estate and value it with the discounted cash flow model, add them all up. A lot of work because we have a lot of pieces, then I have to do multiple DCFs. But if you're an intrinsic value believer, that's how you get the sum of the parts. The second is you can do pricing. You can take each part and say, if I sold this to somebody else, what would somebody pay me? And you add them all up, you come up with a collective pricing of the assets. The third is you trust the accountants. You take the numbers on the balance sheet, you add them all up and say that's... And a lot of people, when they compare price to book value, are effectively doing that, right? They say, if I sold this company, I'll get that book value back. So let's look at when it's easiest to do asset-based valuation. So I come to you at the company and say, can I do asset-based valuation of the company? The first thing you're looking at is, are the assets separable? So let's say I came to you with Disney. There's a lot of talk now about how Disney might be worth more of the sum of its parts. That if you sold off ESPN separately, or you spun off, made ESPN an independent company, maybe we took the Disney theme parks, the Disney movies, the Disney broadcasting, made them all separate companies, the company could be worth more. What's the problem, though, with breaking Disney down into its parts? When I do Disney theme parks and Disney movies as separate companies, what's the problem I'm going to face? If Frozen does well, it's not just Frozen that gets the cash flows, right? The theme parks get the spillover. The toys get the spillover. Disney is going to be a much tougher company to value as the sum of its parts than a mining company with six different, you know, maybe of iron ore mines and gold mines and coal mines, and you can separate them and sell them off. So the more separable your assets are, the easier it is to do sum of the parts valuation. The second is, it's nice if I can get the standalone earnings and cash flows for each part of each business. Now you see why most people don't even try to do this for companies, because getting that can be difficult. And finally, it's nice if I can get an active market for each separate asset. Right, because I've got to come up with a number for each part of the company. So I'm going to take an example to do this, but now let's think about this in the context of which you're doing it. If you're doing a liquidation valuation, what are you planning to do? You're going to come up with the values of the assets, then you're going to go looking for people who will pay you that price. And here's the catch. Let's say you want to do a liquidation valuation of Glencore. Under what conditions will you do liquidation valuation if the company is in real trouble, right? Do you have to liquidate quickly or do you have a lot of time on your side? You've got to liquidate quickly. And if you have to liquidate quickly, what do you often have to accept? A discount. So if you're doing a liquidation valuation, one of the things you might do is come up with the values of the parts and say, look, I'm in a hurry to liquidate it. So let's say Las Vegas Sands got into trouble and you want to sell the Venetian. How many potential buyers are there? Three, and they're all in Vegas, and they're all in trouble when you're in trouble too, right? Steve Wynn is in trouble, you know, Caesar. So effectively, you're with this very narrow market, you might have to attach a liquidation discount. How much the discount is, we'll come back and talk about, but that's the first thing, is liquidation valuation. The second is accounting valuation. About 10 years ago, when they were writing the rules for fair value accounting, the rule writers gathered together in New York and they had a panel and they had people come in and talk to them about what they were planning to do. And they asked me whether I'd come in and talk about what their end mission was. Against my better judgment, I said yes. And then because I'd said yes, I said I have to read the rules that they're writing. And the rule that actually encompasses fair value accounting is called FAS 157. Okay. And this is what it says. FAS 157 says that the number you should attach to a company is the price that would be received to sell the asset to transfer, not the price to acquire. I have no idea what that even means. But there's this constant talk of what a market participant will pay you, and that's the number you should be attaching as the number to an asset. So it's called fair value accounting, but if they want you to put a number on an asset based on what somebody will pay for that asset right now, you know what a better word for it might be? Instead of fair value accounting, what should we call it? It's fair price accounting, right? It's not really value, it's fair price accounting. Fair value accounting is fair price accounting. You think, so what? The problem is accountants can't seem to get their heads around the difference between price and value. Not only do they call it fair value accounting when they want accountants to do pricing, they want you to do a DCF valuation to justify the price. Now do you see why accountants have so much trouble with fair value accounting? Your mission is to price things, but the way you back up that price is by doing what? By doing a discount. It's a wrong tool for the wrong purpose. If you want to do fair price accounting, what should all accountants be required to do? Pick a multiple, pick comparables, be done, move on. No discounted cash flow valuation. This is actually becoming a huge issue with private equity funds, and even public investors are invested in these small private, like Snapchat. Fidelity knocked down the pricing for Snapchat by 25%. Why did they knock it down? Because there were probably some transactions which happened at a lower price. Oh my God, $15 billion is too high a number. Because the way they price it is they look at the most recent transaction and they extrapolate. So the $15 billion came from that Alibaba transaction in Snapchat, extrapolated was $15 billion. It's probably another transaction that happened 3 months later, which gave them $11 billion value. So they've marked down the price. I have no problem with them marking down the price. But here's what they have to do with the regulators. They actually have to show a discounted cash flow model to justify why they marked down the price. I would not even want to touch that discounted cash flow valuation, because I can't imagine how many first principles will get broken to get to $11 billion. But accounting fair value is accounting fair price, and the sooner we accept that, the better. But as long as the rules are written, you're going to have to do a discounted cash flow valuation to justify pricing for each asset. Which brings me to the part which I'm most interested in. I'm not an accountant, so I don't care about accounting fair value. Liquidation valuation, you hardly ever run into. It's a very pragmatic decision. It's a sum of the parts valuation. I keep hearing about these companies that would be worth more broken up than as individual companies. In fact, many activists, this is one of the things that they often do, is they target a company, they say you'd be worth more broken up into two, three. You saw HP break up into two companies last year. So this is stock. Some of the parts must be worth more than the whole. And often you see analysts say this company is worth more as the sum of its parts than as an individual combined company. Talk is easy. If you really want to back this up, you have to come up with numbers. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to take a company where I think the sum of the parts approach works really well. It's a company that you might be familiar with. It's called United Technologies. Think of it as a poor man's GE. Right? It's got many of the characteristics of GE. It's in multiple, very different businesses, but not as many as GE. So I didn't want to handle GE. That would be too messy because I couldn't even fit it on a page. I'd need 3 pages for the number of businesses. So these are the 6 businesses that United Technologies is in. So there are the divisions of United Technology. So the refrigeration systems, defense, construction, security, manufacturing, and aircraft. You see why already this is a good candidate for some of the parts? 6 very different businesses. This is not like theme parks and broadcasting. We have spillover. If you have good aircraft, it doesn't really help you. The fact that you have Sikorsky helicopters all over doesn't help you in the defense business, the construction business. So 6 different businesses. The other reason I picked United Technologies is they give me a lot of detail in each business. In what sense? Not only do they give me revenues by business, which most companies do, they also give me an EBITDA, pre-tax, operating income, CapEx, and depreciation, as well as their judgment of what the total assets in each business are. You're going to see why this is going to help me when I do an intrinsic valuation of each part, but I had the information on each piece. So I'm going to do a I'm going to try to get a sum of the parts number for United Technologies, starting with the laziest way of doing it. And you can probably see already what it is. I have an EBITDA for each business, right? If you have 5 minutes to come up with a sum of the parts number for United Technologies, what's the quickest way you can come up with it? You have the EBITDA for 6 different businesses. What are you going to do? Apply a multiple in EV to EBITDA for each business, right? Based on what? Based on what other companies in the sector are priced at. So basically what I did was I looked up the average for each sector. I took the EBITDA for each business and multiplied by the EV to EBITDA for the sector. So if you get that, you come up with the value of each business. You add them up, you come up with the value of the sum of the parts. Now, what are the dangers of doing this? When I use the sector average EV to EBITDA on the EBITDA at United Technologies, what am I telling you about that division relative to the sector? That it's just like the sector. Same risk, same cash flow, same growth, right? And that can get you into trouble. Unfortunately, this is what most analysts mean when they do sum of the parts valuation. This is it. This 5-minute pricing is what passes for sum of the parts valuation. Now, if I really wanted to price these divisions, is there a better way I could price them? Define, describe, analyze, apply, right? I mean, I don't have to use EV to EBITDA for each sector. I could pick the best multiple in each sector. I could control for differences between the sector and the rest of this division and the rest of the sector. And that's effectively what I did is I took the 6 different businesses, I tried different multiples, and I picked the regression that seemed to do the best job in each sector. So now I've given up on using EV to EBITDA for all 6. I now have different multiples, EV to EBITDA, EV to revenues, EV to capital. I've tried to stay with EV because it makes my life a little simpler. But I've got 3 different multiples for 6 different sectors. I also have a regression, so I can plug in the numbers for each division into the system. So I know the divisional return on capital. So basically, I plug in the numbers for each division into the regression. I come up with a predicted multiple for each. So you see the difference. Instead of applying an average, I'm picking different multiples for each division, and then I'm controlling for differences between that division and the rest of the sector. I come up with predicted values. So I add them up. I come up with $74.23 billion as the pricing for these divisions, controlling for differences in the sector. So the $61 billion is kind of a rough estimate of the pricing. The $74 billion, in my view, is a much more precise estimate of the pricing, but they're both pricing. Could I do an intrinsic valuation of each division? To do an intrinsic valuation, what do I need? I need cash flows, I need growth, and I need a cost of capital, right? So here's what I did. I first started off by getting a cost of capital for each business, which wasn't difficult because I have the unlevered beta. The way I look at beta is because I get a beta for each business, I have that already. I came up with a cost of equity and a cost of capital for each business, and they range from 7.72% for Pratt and, I'm sorry, 6.78% for UTC Fire and Security to 9.82% for Sikorsky. Different cost of capital. So I've got one piece nailed down. I need an expected growth rate. To get the expected growth rate, I got the return on capital and reinvestment rate for each business. And you can see there's some really bad businesses like fire and security and some really good ones like Hamilton Sunstrand and Sikorsky, which have high returns on capital, different returns on capital, different reinvestment rate. So it's six different DCF valuations with each division having its own cost of capital, its own growth rate, and its own cash flows. I did a discounted cash flow valuation again, allowing for different growth periods. Because I have six DCFs, I don't have to use five for everyone or 10 for everyone. I come up with growth rates in perpetuity and growth rates in the high growth period. And you can see very different growth rates by business. I have cash flows, I have cost of capital, I have growth rates. I get a value as a business. Based on the discounted cash flow valuation of the pieces, the value of the six businesses put together is $80.255 billion. Now do you see why people don't want to do some of the parts valuation right? That was, even with that very, very rough set of numbers, you had six different DCFs that you had to juggle around. And would I do it? If I were actually acquiring a company to break it up, I hope I would do this, because otherwise I'm buying it on a pricing and hoping that something good happens. But if you really want to do a sum of the parts valuation, it'll take a lot of work. In fact, if you wanted to, you can break down by business and by geographical area, right? You can see whether your Latin American operations in aircraft are, you know, so you could actually do it by business. And sometimes you might have no choice. If you're selling off a business, you might have to do it. But if you do want to do a full sum of the parts, this is the pathway to doing it. Any questions on? So I add them up, I come up with $80.255 billion. But this is one company, right? And with big companies, there is this one loose end that you have to tie up. You know what it is? I've got the EBITDA by division, I've got a value, I've got the cash flows, I've got a cost of capital, I've got a value for the six businesses. But then I scan the rest of the income statement, and you see an item called corporate expenses. These are the expenses that they could not allocate to the divisions because they're associated with running the entire company. You see why that should worry? I can't ignore that, because that expense is not going to go away if I just break this up into parts, because now each business will need its own headquarters. That expense was $408 million for United Technologies as a company. So I made a simplifying assumption. I said, let's assume that that's a growing perpetuity. Why? Because the headquarters are the headquarters. You don't need them to grow at the same rate as the businesses. I'm going to use the cost of capital for United Technologies as a company. This is the only place where you see the company's cost of capital show up, because it's for the entire company. And the present value that I get for those corporate expenses is $4,587. You're saying, what does that mean? That is the present value, the costs associated with keeping these parts together. If I subtract that from the 80.25, I come up with the value of the operating assets of 75.66, which actually is very close to what I got by using those adjusted multiples, but that was just pure luck. And of course, you got the value of the operating assets if you do a pure DCF, and the value that I got by the back of the envelope pricing when I use the multiples, four different numbers. So if I do a sum of the parts DCF, the value that I get is 75.66, and that's the value that I would use to get the value per share, and I have to decide what to do next. Have you heard of this notion of a conglomerate discount? So in some of your other classes, you might have talked about this. What exactly is the conglomerate discount? And how do analysts use it? How do investors use it? How does it get talked about? What is the conglomerate discount? It is a discount, it might come from complexity. Actually, that's a good point. We'll come back to why is there a conglomerate. But what is the conglomerate discount itself? What is that phenomenon? Yeah. How do we know that? What is it based on? In fact, that's often said. There is a conglomerate discount of roughly 7 to 10%. That's what you'd often see in finance books. And people take that to the next step. How do they come up with that 7 to 10% discount? Remember that pricing I did, the very simplistic pricing? That's what these researchers do, is they take 50 conglomerate companies, they take the divisions, They apply the pricing. They forget about the corporate expenses. So the first question I would have is, how the hell do you know there's a conglomerate discount? You haven't even done it right. Assuming there's a conglomerate discount, then we can ask the question, why is it there? And it could be because conglomerates are complex, in which case breaking them up is going to fix the problem. What are the reasons might there be for why conglomerates traded a discount? Maybe you lose focus. That's another weapon of mass distraction, right? Focus. So you get, when you lose focus, what happens? You run each business a little worse than the other companies in that business. So maybe you have lower margins, lower cash flow. So the conglomerate discount might be coming from the fact that you're badly managed and badly run and maybe breaking your... What I'm saying is don't take these words at face value. If somebody says Sony is worth more as its parts than it has as a compare, and the reason they give is there's a conglomerate discount of 7 to 10%, that is extremely sloppy reasoning. You're applying a discount that was based on, 100 companies that were badly priced, and you came to this conclusion. So when people talk about conglomerate discounts, is there one? The only way to answer it is to take the company in question and do it right. Either price it right or value it right, and then make your own judgment as to whether there's a discount. Don't automatically assume that there is one and it'll somehow go away magically by breaking the company apart. Okay. Any other questions on some of the parts? Valuation. So now let's talk about valuing private companies. First time I ever came in contact with a lot of private company appraisers was about 24 years ago, and I was asked to give a keynote talk to a group of ASA, NACVA, there are all these acronyms for appraisal business. And there's hundreds of people in a room, and I came in, and most of them were private company appraisers. And much of what I'd done up till then was in valuing public companies. And it's so nice to value public companies. The information is out there. You can come up, you can make this assumption about investors being diversified. You can use a beta, cost of equity, and a cost of capital. So when I first got in contact with private companies, the first question I'd ask was, should I toss out everything I know about valuation and start from scratch? And the lucky answer to that question was no. You can build off the same base because, in a sense, the process of valuing a private company is no different than the process of valuing a public company. Let me explain what I mean by that. To value a public company, what do I need to do? I need to estimate cash flows. I need to estimate a growth. I need to estimate a discount rate, right? It's exactly the same process. I need to estimate cash flows, growth rate, discount rate. I can value a private company. When I value a private company, though, there are two fundamental problems that are going to make it more difficult. Some of you are actually valuing private companies, so you know exactly what I'm talking about. The first is that there is no market value out there for either debt or equity. With a public company, you have your value, but there is a market value of equity and debt, at least a market value of equity, even if there's none for debt. And second, if you think accounting standards vary across public companies, you should see how much they vary across private businesses, especially small private businesses. I still remember about 10 years ago, somebody in this class, not this class, but a previous version of the valuation class, picked a mother's flower shop to value. And about 6 weeks into the semester, she came in a complete panic. She said, I have to change companies. I said, what's the problem? So I asked my mother for numbers, and she took me into a room covered with Post-it notes. She had the Post-it note accounting system. And it was actually very, very, in her mind, a very well-designed system. What she had were different colored Post-it notes for revenues and expenses, different walls she used. So when her daughter asked, what are your revenues, she said, look at that wall. What are your expenses? Look at that wall. Accrual, cash, nothing, you know, it's all checkbook-based. She said, I can't value the company. And that's often the reaction people have. Private companies, they expect 10Ks and 10Qs. Show me the footnotes. There are none. There might not even be a financial statement. It might just be pulled together. It might be a cash statement. So that's something that gets in the way in terms of valuing private companies. So let's take a closer look at those issues as we come through. First, you think, so what if I don't have a market value? We need market values as inputs into our valuation, right? In what sense? To get the cost of capital, what do we use as weights for debt and equity? Market value of equity, and even if you cheat and use book debt, but you're supposed to use market debt. So the public company, that's not a big deal. If I asked you to value Apple, it's no problem getting the market value of equity and debt. With a private company, you're going to get stuck right then. I don't have a market value of equity and I don't have a market value of debt. If a public company grants options, remember how we valued the options? We took the market price and used it as an input to value options. With private businesses, valuing options is much more difficult. Second, when you finished your DCF valuation, right after you got that value for your company, what's the first number you checked? You checked the price. And if the price was really different from your value, what did you do? You went back and revisited your numbers. I'm not saying you changed any of the numbers, but it's nice to have that feedback loop that says, if you got $2.23 and the stock is trading at $223, my guess is you missed a unit somewhere, not that you got this massively overvalued stock. It's nice to have that output to compare your value to. So this morning I was valuing Pfizer. I'm actually going to do three valuations of Pfizer. I'm going to call one the Patriot Games valuation, where Pfizer pays a 40% tax rate starting now, Patriot Games, because that's a patriotic thing to do, right? The second is what I'm going to call the delay of gain valuation, which is basically what they're doing now, which is leaving your money overseas, hoping the tax law gets changed, and hoping that by the time the cash comes back, it'll be at a lower tax rate. The third is the inversion valuation, which you become a Pfizer becomes an Irish company, which is what the plan is after they merge with Allergan. And then you pay regional taxes. So three different values, but with each of the value, the first time I actually valued, the first valuation I did of Pfizer, I came up with $26.15 per share. The first thing I checked was, hey, what's the price at? $32.50, I'm okay. $325, maybe not. So it's nice to have the market value as an output. And we do use market prices for a lot of our risk measures as well, right? If you come up with a beta from a regression, that regression needs market prices. We're a lot more dependent on market prices than we let on when we do intrinsic valuation. You're going to take that input away from me. Second, as I said, the way you estimate cash flows is no different for a private company than a public company. You start with after-tax operating income. You subtract out net capex. You subtract out change in working capital. You get cash flows. But here's the problem. With public companies, I have a lot of history. So when I sat down to value Pfizer, I was able to, from Capital IQ, pull up 25 years of every number I wanted, revenues, operating income, taxes. I had data coming out of every single place I could get. So essentially, I had lots of data to value. But to value a private company, often you might have 2 years of data, 3 years of data, because it's been around only a couple of years. The second is, as I said, the accounting standards vary widely across private businesses, especially small private businesses. The third is what I call the George Costanza effect. You ever seen the Seinfeld episodes? What did George do? He was the assistant equipment manager for the Yankees. What the hell does that even mean? I think there was only one episode where he actually did something. Remember when he turned their uniforms into polyester or something and the Yankees started sweating? That's the only episode out of hundreds and hundreds where he actually seemed to do something. The rest of the time he was talking to the back of George Steinbrenner's head. He said, what the heck does he do? He said, what's this got to do with private company valuation? You walk into a private business, you look and say, what does he do? I don't know. What does he do? I don't know. What's that 12-year-old doing? I don't know. They all have the same last name as the owner. They all collect salaries. No idea what they do. The line between the personal and the business expense is a very gray one in a private business. That company car, every evening at 4 o'clock seems to magically go away. Where? Pick up kids at school and come back. Office, home office, right? You have the home office from which you, how come there are kids' toys in the corner of that office? The line between the personal and the business expense is a much grayer one with private businesses. And finally, you run a private business. You own it, 100% owner. You run a restaurant. You're the guy behind the counter. You might not pay yourself a salary. Even though you work, 18 hours a day, your inventory keeper, accounts manager, auditor, janitor, everything enrolled into one. Why do you care about not collecting a salary? Because you're going to get whatever's left over. So you say, who cares whether I pay myself a salary? I'm going to get whatever's left over anyway. So I'm not going to. You see why this is going to be dangerous, though? Let's say you decide to buy this restaurant from this guy. let's say I'm the guy who ran the restaurant. I didn't charge myself a salary. I took whatever was left over and claimed that as profit. So you ask me for my income statement. I give you my income statement. I said, last year, my restaurant made $150,000. So you decide to pay 5 times earnings. What's the danger in what you've just done? Did I actually make $150,000 last year? I made $150,000, but I worked like a dog, right? I worked as accountant, janitor. So to value the company, what would you have to do? You'd have to actually figure out what the salary you'd have to pay to replace all the roles I played was, right? So the janitor, then the 30, then the 20, now the 50. By the time you're done, you might end up with a $10,000 profit if you're lucky. And that's what you should be valuing the restaurant at. So that's another issue we did not have to deal with public companies. It'll become an issue with private businesses. So here's my first step in private company valuation. If you came to me with a private business and say, I want a number for my business, I'm going to ask you why. With a public company, I never ask this question. Listen, you show me a public company, I'll value the company. With a private company, if you ask me to value a company, my first question is, why do you want me to do it? And here are some of the reasons. It could be because you're curious, you have a company, you want to know how much, you built up this business, you want to know how much it's worth. So it could be curiosity. It could be for legal purposes. Maybe you're deciding on a divorce and you want a value for the business to split it up. I call these show valuations because really there are no transactions that come out of it and the rules tend to be very different. The second is it could be for a transaction. Transaction in what sense? You could be trying to sell the business to somebody else. It could be because you have 3 partners in a business and you're trying to buy out a partner. It could also be because you're trying to sell yourself to a public company. So it could be for a transaction. But the third is maybe you're a big enough private company that you're thinking about going public. So if I'm Snapchat and I come say, give me a number, I'm doing it because I plan to go public and I want to figure out what I'll get. So I need to know why you want a value. Because if you're looking at a private business, that motive is going to drive what you get as an end number, and you're going to see where it's going to show up in the valuation. If you're a public company, you might still have to use some private company issues if it's a piece of your company you're trying to sell off. As one of the things that came out of the AB InBev, SAB Miller merger, what is SAB Miller going to be required to sell off? It has to sell off the 50-something percent it owns, of course. It has a 50% voting, but it's actually only, it owns 56%, of course, to Molson. There is going to be, so it's going to look very much like a private company transaction because this is the division of a company, so essentially you have to work through some of the issues that you work with a private company. So in spin-offs and spin-outs and some of the parts valuation, you might have to value pieces just like I did for United Technologies. So everybody needs to at least think about how to value private business. So what I'm going to do is actually go through 4 different scenarios. The first is I'm going to value a private company for sale to another private individual. I'm going to call it private to private and look at, this is the most complex of the private company valuations. You're going to see why. So one individual selling to another. You're saying, when would this show up? Any small business. This is the most likely scenario. You're trying to sell your restaurant. You're trying to sell it to somebody else who's buying the restaurant. You're a doctor trying to sell your practice. You're selling to another doctor. My dentist in my town is getting to a point where he's trying to sell his practice. He's going to probably have to sell to another dentist who's going to be investing all his money in the dental practice, private to private transactions. Then we're going to talk about private to public transactions. We're valuing a business for sale to a public company. It could be private to IPO because you're planning to go public. Or maybe there's an intermediate stop. You're valuing a private business because of venture capitalists. You've gotten in Shark Tank. Venture capitalists thinking about investing in you, saying, how do I come up with that number? And then that venture capitalist is planning to eventually go public. So we're going to talk about that transitional effect. So private to private, private to public, private to IPO, private to VC to whatever. And you're going to see that the valuation is different depending on which of these scenarios you face. So let's start the process. Let's talk about private to private transactions and what makes them so messy. The first is, I don't know how many of you have families who have family businesses or actually own your own business, but the reality is if you own your own business, you almost never are diversified. Do you see why? Because if you own your own business, what happens? Every dollar that you have goes into the business. And when you're selling to another individual, that individual is also not going to be diversified. The dentist-to-dentist transaction I talked about, the dentist who's selling his practice has almost all of his wealth tied up in the practice, and the dentist who's going to buy his practice is also going to have almost all of his wealth tied up in the practice. You might say, so what? It's going to come back to haunt us, the fact that neither the buyer nor the seller is diversified. Second, when you buy a stake of a private business, almost by definition, that investment is pretty illiquid. As opposed to what? If you've taken that money and bought 10,000 shares of Valiant and you didn't like the investment tomorrow, you could sell it. This transactions cost, bid-ask spread, maybe a but it's small. If you have a private business and you try to sell it, much more difficult to get out. And we have to deal with that illiquidity specifically. We never thought about this with public companies, but with private companies, you absolutely have to deal with it. And the third is what I call the key person effect. You know how this is going to show up in the dental practice sale? The dentist I visit, his name is Dr. Coyle. Really nice guy. And you've got to trust the guy when he has your mouth open with a drill in there. So I go to him because I trust him not to drill all the way into my brain. And I've used him for 15 years. So let's say he sells to another dentist tomorrow. And I show up for my dental appointment in April, which is when I think I have it. I should check. And a new guy comes out and says, I'm your new dentist. And he looks like Frankenstein. I'm getting out of there as fast. Even if he doesn't look like Frankenstein, say, I don't know who the hell you are. Let me go check your Yelp reviews first. You see what that means? That if I, when you look at my numbers, if you look at the dental practice, a lot of this practice is built on the fact that you have people who've been coming to you for 15, 20, 25 years. And the day after you buy this practice as the new dentist, what might happen? Half the people might disappear. It's what I call the key person discount. With private company valuation, it becomes a big issue. If that key person leaves, how much of your value? You think that's impossible to estimate? You better estimate it, because if to pay for this business, you have to figure out what you have to take off the value. And we'll talk about what the seller might do to keep the value intact. In fact, let's think about it. If I'm the dentist who's selling the practice and I'm selling to this new guy who's worried about half the practice disappearing, the day I leave, how might I smooth this process out to keep that discount from getting too large? What might I offer to do? This actually happens a lot with doctor and medical and dental practice. Keep your name, but more than the name, you actually probably have to have a transition period. And many doctors and dentists actually do this, where the old guy will hang around for about 6 months to a year, and then little by little kind of let go. I know he wants to go to Florida or Bahamas or wherever, but if he goes right away, he loses half the value. But if he can hang in there 6 months or a year, he might lose only 5% of the value. So with private company valuation, these are the little nuances that come up that have to show up in evaluation. So let's think about a very simple example. Let's assume that it's May, you've graduated, you've gone to work for an investment bank. And 3 months later, you decide it's not for you. Too much work, 7 days a week, 15 hours a day, plugging and chugging into spreadsheets. So you decide that you want to do your lifelong dream, which is to run your own restaurant. And you're going to take your entire wealth, which is not that much, but whatever it is, and you're going to buy the restaurant. So the owner is, right now, it's a French restaurant. The owner is also the French chef. This is the restaurant. It's well regarded, both the restaurant and the chef. They're I wouldn't make it a 4-star Michelin. That might be a little 2-star Michelin, at least. Business has been pretty good for the last 3 years. So you're the former investment banker. You've decided to get out of that rat race, cash out all your savings, and put your entire amount in the restaurant. So that those two facts are going to come into play in how much value you attach. So I'm going to give you the financial statements for this restaurant that the French chef has delivered to you. Okay? The restaurant reported $1.2 million in revenues in the most recent year and $400,000 in pre-tax operating profit. firm has no conventional debt outstanding. It has a lease commitment of $120,000 a year for the next 12 years. You ready? Here's what the numbers look like on the restaurant. You're the buyer, I'm the seller. I'll show you the numbers. Those are my revenues. You can see they're climbing. Little catch. Last year, I made a lot of money, but every table is pretty much full. So, you know, with this restaurant, you can't add to capacity. Operating lease expense, $120,000 a year. There are wages that I have to pay for the kitchen staff, but I've never drawn a salary. It's my restaurant. I never bother. Keep that in mind when you decide to buy the restaurant, that I've not factored in a salary for the chef. Okay? Material, 25% of revenues, other operating expenses, tax rate. I have my income. Looks like a pretty good restaurant, right? $240,000. Couple of issues. One is that I haven't charged myself a salary. The other is I'm treating lease expenses as operating expenses. Just because you have a private company doesn't mean you can abandon all the things we talked about with public companies. So here's the first thing I did. I said, okay, I'll come back to that financial statement, but first I need to figure out, or you need to figure out, what discount rate you would demand, what cost of capital to use. Okay? You think this is easy? I'm an MBA, I've got betas, I've got risk premiums, risk free rates, I took the valuation class, you're ready to plug and chug. The only problem is when you take beta times the risk premium plus risk free rate, you're looking at only that portion of the risk that you cannot diversify away. That works if you're diversified, but what did I just tell you about this restaurant? You're going to take all of your wealth and put it into this restaurant. So you're not diversified, and that's going to mean that what you get as your required return, cost of equity, cost of capital, is going to be too low if you just plug numbers into conventional risk and return models. And second, you, of course, don't have the market prices to run these regressions anyway. So you kind of throw up and say, what the hell do I do? So the first thing I need is to come up with a cost of equity and cost of capital. I'm going to start with the conventional approach. I'm going to go find publicly traded restaurants. You're saying, that thing, I'm not, doesn't matter. Just go to where the data is. And right now, the average unlevered beta across 75 publicly traded companies is 0.86. But before I use it, I have to stop and think. This is a highly regarded French chef and a French restaurant. You know what's in that publicly traded restaurant group? McDonald's, Burger King, etc. Applebee's might be the most high-end of your restaurants here. You're a very expensive French restaurant. I said, you know what? Maybe that's not the beta I should be looking for. The beta I actually ended up using was a beta for 45 high-end retailers. The kinds of people who will come and eat at your restaurant and pay $100 a meal are the kinds of people who will shop at Gucci's and Tiffany's. And the unlevered beta for those retailers is 1.18. So I had to make a judgment call. I won't go with the restaurant business, given the kind of restaurant you are. The beta I'm going to use is 1.18. That's my unlevered beta. Now, remind me again, when I got an unlevered beta for public companies, to get a levered beta, what did I do? I looked at the public company's debt-to-equity ratio, right? But what debt-to-equity ratio did I use, a market or a book? There's a market debt-to-equity ratio, and I'm in deep trouble now. Do you see why? Because I have an unlevered beta for this company of 1.18, but I don't have a market debt-to-equity, and I also have this problem of this beta measures the risk to a diversified investor. I'm going to pause there because when we come back, I want to build on the theme. What do I do to bring in the fact that you're not diversified into the beta, and what do I do about the fact that I don't have market debt and market equity to come up with a levered beta?
I know it's bad, but like...
I'll check my email. Why don't you send it again? Because I don't remember sending it back. I don't remember reading. So it might have been sent back.
Please, because I think we need to talk.
Okay.
Thank you.
Okay. Take care. Hey. Hey, how are you?
What's up?
Not much?
I got a quick question for you.
Yeah.
So do you know what that expensive site is that...
I could find out for you, because I think that... It's Stanford has it and Wharton has it. I don't know whether we might even have.
I didn't see anything in the. I just can't figure out what. If you have any idea what the name is, that's all I need, just so I can say, because the national like venture capital return site isn't I just don't know how to get. I don't know how to get it by. I know this has nothing to do with you just being a very
by
nice.
By layers.
What?
You want to get it by layers, right? Early investment.
Yeah, well, like just like so. Here's the pre-money, and they put this amount in. What was the return over the last 5 years?
You know where I've seen those numbers is when I was looking at pricing ratchets that venture capitalists put in. I found data on
pricing ratchets.
You know what ratchets are? Basically, these are downside protections that venture capitalists put into their investments. Where if you go for additional capital, you have to raise their own.
So they don't get diluted or whatever.
Exactly. Okay. So that's what a ratchet is. So I was trying to price it, and in the process, I was looking at data on venture capitalism. And I was able to get, let me check, because I was able to get public data by layers of venture capital.
Yeah, that's, so I'm just, basically this fund doesn't really know what they're doing, and they just want to know whether or not there's any data to support the fact that, you know, they're only a co-investor, so they want to know whether they should just kind of follow on at a lower ownership stake, but at a higher post-money valuation, even though they're only, so companies that have either higher growth or more, higher.
So their strategy requires them to know the pre-money and the post-money.
Yeah. And they have to know the lead investors very well, right? So it's all about.
And what percentage lead investors? So what? No, in other words, what's the information they would like? So if you could know.
So they want to know if. Let's
say they were investing in Uber. What do they know? They need to know the pre-money, the post-money, the percentage of the company held by VCs.
No, well, they would want to know at the time at which Uber was small,
right.
or they were raising a seed round, what the pre-money and post-money valuations
right.
were, and what 300,000. What ownership amount that would give them of the company.
Okay.
And at that ownership amount, what has...
So all they need is pre- and post-money, because the 300,000 is a constant, right?
Yeah. So the 300,000 is constant. They're just trying to understand how sensitive their returns over the next 5 years would be at, call it, at a big seed rate, at like a 20 million versus a, you know, call it 6 million post-money valuation, right? So are they better off trying to take more risk on smaller post-money...
To be more diversified and have lots of small holdings and less diversified.
Yeah, exactly.
You might not even need VC-level data. That's actually a very statistical question, right? Because in a sense, if you take all the pre-money and post-money valuations across and you can show that the correlation, it's like creating a portfolio effect, right? So let's suppose you have $30 million to invest. You can put $30 million in one company. You can take $300,000 and buy 100 companies. That's
right.
Really the question you're asking. Am I better off? So it's really a question of, what's the correlation across returns in pre- and post-money?
Is it that, or is it investing the same amount, that 300K, in a 20 million versus a 6 million post? And what's
does the percentage matter?
So does the percent also matter?
So basically looking at two dimensions. One is, should you spread the investments across lots of investments? And the second is, should you take larger percentages of smaller companies or smaller percentages of larger companies?
It's more the latter. It's the second.
Okay. I'll check to see.
Okay.
I mean, there might actually be studies that have looked at the VC data that have tried to answer.
The site that you're talking about.
No, not the site. I'm on. If you check SSRN, which is the Social Science Research Network, just SSRN.com.
Okay, I'll check that.
That is every working paper written in finance by academics and practitioners actually gets put there. So it's hundreds of thousands of papers. So you go in and you put in a search, VC returns or small.
Yeah.
You'll see every paper that's been written in the last 10 years on it, including the most recent papers. And if nothing else, then what you can do is you can find a paper that talks about VC returns by small versus large. And then if you're lucky, look at the database that they reference, because all these studies. But I'll check as well.
The problem I'm having is just the size of the investment, because I don't know what the post-money
is. The reason that might be difficult is it's self-reported by
that's
VC,
what I'm
right? So in a sense, it's as unlike public companies where there's an SEC requirement that everybody has to report. VCs, it's a much looser structure where VC can invest in your own notes.